Blog Talk Radio.
We've got film, and we've got psychology. When we put the two together, we've got filmcology. Each week, we will look at the psychology of the characters in film, and it gives us something lovely to think about. So, let's get started. Filmcology is now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Thursday. And this is a little bit different. We haven't done this before, where we compare a couple of movies at the same time. The main movie that started back in 1938 was a Howard Hawks film called Bringing Up Baby. And if you haven't gotten a chance to take a look at the trailer, then you probably don't realize just how hilarious it all is and how you can see subtle similarities, I guess, in the second movie, which is What's Up, Doc? It's a Peter Bogdanovich film. So I'm going to try to talk about both of those at the same time and give you some kind of psychological review on all that, because it's really, if you really think about romantic comedies really talk about the process of falling in love and trying to get the love going and sort of what happens when you're in love. They sort of are a good analogy of what love does to us when we fall in love. It just, utter chaos can happen. And in probably because when we fall in love, I mean, this is an oversimplification. I hope that you understand that. This is not to take that, you know, you're falling, if you have just fallen in love with someone, it doesn't mean that your life is going to turn into one of these movies. It certainly doesn't guarantee that it won't, but love has a really strange way of affecting a lot of people, vastly different and yet somehow similar. Excuse me. If you have ever read anything by Shakespeare, then you understand that none of this is new. None of this is something that nobody's ever really heard of before. Even if you were to write a romantic comedy about a robot and a dog or something like that, I mean, we have movies like WALL-E where the little robots fell in love with each other, animated units. And there was heartfelt feelings between the little cockroach and the little garbage compactor WALL-E. Love can happen anywhere. It just somebody that you become close to and it warms your heart. But, excuse me, but love is a real topsy-turvy roller coaster ride. So even if you were to, just to pop this in here, even if you were to look at a dramatic love story where somebody gets cancer and is dying and, of course, finds the absolute love of their life, like, I don't know, 6 months before they're diagnosed with cancer that's terminal and inoperative or something like that. Or they go off to sea. We have love stories like that that show up in, like, The Perfect Storm. And then there's Brian's Song. Those are some of the, you know, different ones. There's all kinds of love stories. Oh, the, well, Tried, Tired, whatever, Twilight, whatever, that vampire movie, it's all the same thematic issues. Does the person that catch my eye, do they see me? What can I do to make them see me? And, you know, all that kind of, am I good enough? And all that kind of weird stuff. It's all mixed in there. And the romantic comedy is much easier for us psychologically to handle because we still have some laughs and we don't key in so much to the tragedy of, like, some Shakespeare. But actually, Shakespeare had a lot of romantic comedies, Much Ado About Nothing and Kiss Me, Kate. Well, there's a whole bunch of them. But, well, take, for instance, Othello. That was a dramatic love story, but it could easily have been turned into a comedy because somebody's doing something they shouldn't, somebody's doing this, one person's off with another, there's all these miscues, and everything gets misunderstood, and it turns into a big mess. And except that usually in the romantic comedies, it all ends up well somehow. Because we, of course, don't have to see what's going to happen after these two get together, after this chaotic nightmare. I would say that if you were going to go by logic, which I like to use, most likely, a romantic comedy, the end has to be that everything's working out at that particular moment, because if we were to see real life with those two chaotic individuals, it would then probably end up being a tragedy or a murder mystery. Detective show, what happened to the body, what happened. I suppose I shouldn't laugh at that, but when you really think about it, that really not much else that could come of that. Now let's start with bringing up Baby. I'm going to try to look at the introduction of both at the same time, because Bringing Up Baby starts with this really straight-laced professor. They say he's a zoologist. I'm not quite sure why he's not. Well, okay. They say he's a zoologist. So he studies old dinosaurs, and he's trying to put together this big giant dinosaur. Howard Hawks is the director, is really excellent at making sort of glib and slang, kind of really hipper type slang type language with his dialogue. And so you do start to, you get a good sense of how people talk when the film was made. This was made in 1938, so it was the 1940s, which is really obvious by the costumes that Katharine Hepburn was wearing. And also the sort of Art Deco stylized upper wealth type scenery that we see in there. So we start out with this straight-laced guy in a museum, and he's in the position of the thinking man, you know, Rodin's thinking man sculpture, and he's just got his hand in his kind of on his head, kind of, or his chin in his hand, and he's really, really thinking. And of course somebody in the museum walks by in a lab coat and starts to talk to a nice-looking woman with glasses who's clearly more scholarly, or, you know, you can tell that she's not what you would consider the fun-loving type. And she shushes the other doctor in the museum, like, hush, doctor, why his name is escaping me at the moment, but Dr. Huxtable is thinking, like, nobody speak in this big giant museum because Dr. Huxtable is sitting there thinking. It's just insane, but it's so Howard Hawks. I mean, I have to apologize, folks, because I sound a little bit weird, because I have a little bit of a sore. I have a sore. It's not a scab. It's nothing creepy. It's just I bit my tongue, and it hurts. So, okay. So I'm trying to avoid that part of my tongue, and I sound a little bit weird. Okay, so he's sitting there thinking. And immediately talks about how when he kind of comes out of his thinking stance, that he thinks, he says something that sounds sort of ridiculous already. It's like, I think this bone, it's a little segment of this dinosaur bone. I think this bone goes in the tail. And, of course, she immediately corrects him because she's one of those who's, I guess a good phrase would be anal about everything being perfectly and right and no nonsense. And she says, no, that's, you already tried. She said, no, that can't be. And he's, why? Because you tried that last week. So he's the doctor, but she's telling him what he needs to know. You're going to see that same process in What's Up, Doc, when we see Madeline Kahn, who is one of the most brilliant comedic actresses of all time. And I didn't realize that this was her, they introduced her in this movie, so it's introducing Madeline Kahn, so this might have been her debut. I didn't really check on that, but I'd never really noticed that, but when I watched the movie again, I noticed that, and I thought, oh, that it took some kind of brainiac to figure out that this woman was gold, and she was always telling the person in her movie, which was Ryan O'Neill, what to do, because she's the strong, stoic type who takes care of everything. And of course, we need those kind of people to take care of the brainiacs who can't remember anything because they're so immersed in their work. There is nothing outside their vision and focus except their work. That's sort of how we put up our nice little contrast. How do opposites attract? I think a lot of people prefer movies that are opposites attract, kind of comedic or romances, because what that tells us psychologically is, hey, even I could get somebody that I may not be worthy of, or somebody that would never look at me. So, if you were in love with Elvis and maybe you were some little Mexican girl who was a migrant worker, you know, if you saw one of these romantic comedies and you adored and loved Elvis, it would make you think sort of that, hey, maybe Elvis could fall in love with me. Because I've seen him in all these wonderful romantic comedies that Elvis does where he's pitted against a nun. I think he was pitted against a nun in one movie or pitted against some girl who's either fun-loving and he's straight or he's more fun-loving and she's the straight one. So, okay, now we know romantic comedies tell us that, yeah, even people that are completely in different classes, different societal classes, different ages, different financial statuses, all these differences that are huge, the big chasm gets lowered. It's possible. And that's another reason that romantic comedies are so nice and why a lot of women like them, because it helps us to, I don't know, support the fact that we're, well, I do know, support the fact that we can get whoever it is we choose to get. And men, I quite honestly, how they see romantic comedies is a little bit different. Generally, how men view movies is just a little bit different. Now, for Gaetano, he, first of all, he doesn't watch a lot of movies because he's Mr. Business all the time and our family, but one of the his favorite comedies is My Cousin Vinny. Yeah, what does it have to do with this movie? Well, it just has to do with the whole romantic comedy thing. But he loves My Cousin Vinny and often relates it to the way that we are, how he is and how I am. We do seem sort of different at times because he's pretty, he's more take care of business and I'm not always. So, we're moving along. In the beginning, we have Howard Bannister in What's Up, Doc? Versus Huxley, Dr. Huxley, Cary Grant. So Ryan O'Neill, he's the way Peter Bogdanovich put him in, he made him even more out of touch with the rest of the world, whereas Cary Grant's character, Dr. Huxley, we see a glimmer that he actually still wants to be in the romantic pursuits of life. Because in the very beginning, we learned that Dr. Huxley is going to marry Miss Swallow, which is the young lady who's telling him that his bone isn't in the right place. And so he's talking to her about that the fact they're going to get married in the next day. And he makes an overture towards her that's more loving, that he goes to kiss her, and she basically, Miss Swallow, the really stoic woman, says, "Hey, no, you can't do that right now." And it's like, "Well, we're going to get married after all tomorrow." It's like, yes, but because they just found this new bone that was going to complete his big dinosaur. She says, "Yes, but as soon as we get married, we're going to come right back here and finish the statue." And he goes, "But we're going to have a honeymoon." "Well, we don't have time for a honeymoon." And he says, "Well, I mean, gee whiz." He's telling her, "We're going to, you know, we have to, you know, we're getting married. We have to have a honeymoon. You have a family." And she said, "We won't have time for children. Will be our child," she says in a dramatic manner, and points to the gigantic dinosaur. And even the other doctor looks at the dinosaur like, "What?" And Dr. Huxley goes, "Well, yeah, what?" And he looks up like, "How the heck is that going to be our child?" Like, it, you have a nice glimpse that he's not completely down with being completely immersed into his field. So we do see that first crack in that relationship that probably won't work. And that's really enlightening to us from a psychological point of view, because that means that when we are attracted to the opposite, and if they are already with someone else, we still have a chance. Okay, so shifting over to What's Up, Doc? Peter Bogdanovich, he did a subplot in his movie about the case, which case, who's got the case. It's one of those age-old kind of humor things where the luggage looks exactly the same as someone else's luggage that looks exactly the same, that looks the same as someone else's luggage. And what ends up happening is these luggage cases get mixed up like a shell game, going all around and trying to figure out which case has what in it, and they all have something extremely valuable to the people that want them, but not the others. Like one case has clothing, one case has I don't know how many millions in diamond jewelry, another one has top secret files that have been stolen, and then of course there's the case that Dr. Howard Bannister has that are igneous rock. They're hundreds and thousand-year-old rock that he uses to tune sort of a tuning fork. He can tap on them, and then there's melodies that, you know, a certain kind of melody that comes out of that. And so he's trying to point out how important rock really is to musicology. Okay, so we have him. He's so straight-laced and he's so stoic that when we see him on the side, on the curbside at the airport, he's just staring off into space like somebody that you might think is not all there might do. And as he's just staring there off into space, then we hear the shrill of Eunice, the incomparable Madeline Kahn, and she shows up to yell at him because he's not where he should have been. And Madeline has this wonderfully creep, sort of annoying, sort of whiny, high-pitched sound for the voice that she's using. Howard, like when I tell you to be somewhere, you need to stay there. And he just looks over after she's called him a couple of times because he didn't even, he was still out of touch even when she was calling him. And he goes, yes, Eunice. And there's a Skycap who's carrying her bags, and he's standing between the two of them, and she's sort of telling Howard this, Howard, such and such, such and such. And Ryan O'Neill says, yes, Eunice. And then she says, now you're going to da-da-da-da-da. And he says, yes, Eunice. And da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes, Eunice. And then the Skycap, she says, just take our bags over to such and such. And he said, yes, Eunice. Like, it's clear that Eunice has this sort of, she's like Miss Swallow in the first movie, except she is even more annoyingly demanding. Miss Swallow in the first movie, she's a very beautiful woman, but she's all tightened up like a schoolmarm. And in real life, she actually happened to be Howard Hawks's sister-in-law. So I've never really seen her in anything else, but she did a great job for that particular piece. So then we see that Eunice sort of has control over most people because she has that sort of threatening, and she doesn't take really no, and she's sort of like people who nag. They talk sort of over you. They don't really care what you have to say. She basically just tells you how everything is. And so then before we see Howard, we see Howard and Eunice in the taxi as the movie starts to develop, and we see the Barbra Streisand character, Judy, come in, and she's just, she's setting off chaos everywhere she goes. Through sort of no fault of her own, or it's just, it's never really explained why she seems so, she seems to have so many issues. And then we also find out that she's incredibly intelligent. So that makes things a little bit different than Bringing Up Baby, because in Bringing Up Baby, Katharine Hepburn character is just ditzy. As a matter of fact, you hear constantly comments by Dr. Huxley about Katharine Hepburn's character, and it, because she starts frustrating him beyond belief, and he says things like, you bubble-headed, scatterbrained, he says a lot of things under his breath. That's Howard Hawks' trait. People talk fast in Howard Hawks films, really fast. People aren't supposed to really wait for somebody to finish their lines. In Howard Hawks films, generally you hear someone talking before somebody gets a chance to finish their lines, and he does that on purpose to speed up the pace of the film. When you're watching it, it's like you almost have to, he almost forces you to pay closer attention so that you can keep up. Peter Bogdanovich has a lot of interesting dialogue, but he has much more pauses because he wants you to really hear the lines. He really, he tells a lot of jokes in his lines. So there's a lot of those comedic actors and stand-up people, the way that they sort of give those one-liner jokes, well, there's a lot of those in Peter Bogdanovich. And so it's nice to see that contrast in some way, except looking back at the paramours, Streisand and Hepburn, Streisand she moves kind of quickly, but not as quickly as Katharine Hepburn. And Katharine Hepburn is just all over the place. I was looking at the beginning of that film, when David Huxley, his name's David Huxley, played by Cary Grant, when he is on the golf course, all of a sudden this woman just takes over his golf ball and starts playing his golf ball. When he tries to get her to relinquish the golf ball, she completely talks over him and sort of just, he never gets a chance to almost even finish a thought because she's twisting things on him before he gets a chance to even just get out a sentence. So he's on slippery carpet from the first moment he encounters her on the golf course. And he's on the golf course trying to get money from a wealthy woman via her attorney. Well, he's playing a round of golf. That's one of those things you do. You play a round of golf and you settle all the financial stuff. And every time that he is trying to get back to play golf with this guy, this woman, Katharine Hepburn, keeps intervening with some other weird thing that she's doing, and he's got to go tend to. He gets his ball back, and Then the caddy says, hey, mister, isn't that your car? And then Captain Hepburn is in his car. And he's like, you're in my car. And she goes, yeah, can you just help me? He gets roped into trying to help her release his car. And then they end up arguing about his car as she's driving away with him. Meanwhile, the guy he's supposed to be getting money out of is watching him go out the parking lot. So she's putting this big financial issue on him. She's screwing it all up. In What's Up, Doc, Barbra Streisand, she screws things up for Howard Bannister, who is actually there to get an endowment from an extremely wealthy guy, who's played by Austin Pendleton Jr. And I just think he's so adorable. I'm just in love with Austin Pendleton Jr. He's just so hilarious. And he has these incredible blue eyes in the film, What's Up, Doc, with his jet black hair. And he's little guy, and he just has a way of, he has a very intense looking eyes. And he's just really sort of easygoing, but when you see him playing the character, he plays the character straight. He doesn't play the character like a goofball. He, as you watch even in the scenes, when somebody is doing something and he turns and looks back like, what's going on? He's very serious, but there's all this chaos going on. So there's the money issue that's, you know, in both plots. And, of course, Miss Swallow wants David Huxley to get the money, $1 million. And Cunis wants Howard to get the money for his research on this igneous rock. So we meet the Troubled Girls in the very beginning. The Troubled Girls represent, you know, the fun and more than just the fact that they're very different than the other women who are really stoic and tight, so to speak. They represent freedom from everything you're supposed to do. Now, who doesn't want freedom from what you're supposed to do? That takes place in our lives all the time. Let's see. Work on the big D, the dissertation, or watch a monster movie. I like a romantic comedy. First of all, it gets me away from doing my dissertation. Second of all, it makes me think that, hey, maybe if I do just watch monster movies for a week, that somehow it'll all work out. Romantic comedies try to convince you that everything can go to hell in a handbasket, but in the end, you're going to get the girl or the boy, and everything's just going to work out. Yeah. Who wouldn't like a romantic comedy? It's just pure fantasy right there. So, moving along into the film. In the very beginning, Howard Bannister meets this woman in a store, and we get sort of cheap comedy things like Barbra Streisand takes a radio to the counter and says her husband's going to pay for it. And Howard Bannister, who has no idea she's done that, gets a bottle of aspirin, which Eunice told him to get because he had a little hit on the head in the taxi. And she wanted him to be perfect to get the money that night or impress the guy. And also, she told him, make sure you get buffered aspirin, Howard. And so Howard gets the aspirin. He goes up to pay for it while Barbra Streisand stands in the background. She's already told the store clerk that that's her husband, unbeknownst to Howard Bannister. And then Howard Bannister asks how much he owes, and the guy said $68 and something cents. And he said, how much for it without the buffering? wouldn't get completely out. Only people who wouldn't get outrageously upset about that, it would ask such a strange question like, well, is it cheaper without the buffering? Would be the sort of absent-minded scientific nut, you know, straight-laced nutballs that are in their own little world, which I can relate to a lot of times. So I guess that's why I find it even more extremely funny. But so he leaves the aspirin and he goes, and all of a sudden this woman is following him, and he's trying to, he still hasn't got the aspirin. He hasn't done what Eunice wanted him to do. And then Eunice arrives because he was supposed to meet her at the, I think, the room, and she didn't, and he didn't. And then this girl is there, and she's like, Howard, who is this woman? I mean, it's just, that's when she first knows that there's some other nut, a woman who's causing problems. Whereas in Bringing Up Baby, it happens after a whole bunch of hijinks with David Huxley. And she's roped David Huxley into carrying a leopard out to her farm and all this kind of stuff. So Mrs. Swallow, she isn't apprised of some other woman in hijinks until later in the day that she's actually supposed to be getting married, probably around 11 or 12 noon or 1 o'clock, but he's supposed to be marrying her at 3 p.m. So it is slightly different timing. Okay, let's see, we're at, yeah. I'm not going to be able to cover everything, folks, but I'm going to try to bring up some of the similarities that you see in the two movies and the things that are supposed to make us extremely angry. So in the first movie, you almost could be bothered by Katharine Hepburn's character because she keeps causing these problems for this guy. She causes him to slip on an olive because she's playing with olives and throwing them at her mouth, and she's missing. No thought whatsoever that anybody could get hurt, but David Huxley falls. He lands on his top hat. His top head gets smashed, and then she goes to help him and says, I'm so sorry, and he said, I should have known it was you. And she said, well, it's just, he was teaching me a trick about olives. And then, you know, you can't do that without some of them getting away. And he said, it all makes perfect sense. You try to eat an olive, and I end up hitting the floor. And she goes, yes, that was your hat. So she's just totally oblivious to the effects that she has on anybody. Whereas in Bogdanovich's film, Barbra Streisand is quite aware of the effects that she has. And she's actually much more, I wouldn't say cunning. Cunning is not the right word for it. But she's much more, sorry, folks, I've just got to have the perfect word for this. It's another word for planned or, she's, strategizes somewhat more. Well, she strategizes, period, whereas we don't see that at, we really don't see any of that in Katharine Hepburn's character until later she admits that all she really wanted to do was keep David Huxley close to her because she really liked him or she had fallen in love with him. And Judy in Bogdanovich's film, she does do things to cause problems between Howard and his Eunice. And she does things to try to position Howard in better light with the person who's going to be funding somebody's research. And she does a lot of things to try to get the things that she needs, but and to avoid doing what she needs to do, which is, I guess, be in school or something. So anyway, I'm almost getting tired of talking about this whole thing back and forth. Sorry, But it's just sort of weird when you're kind of going back and forth. If you've seen it, well, anyway. So we go along in the film, and let's see, some of the things that happen. Oh, the other difference, big difference for these two films is we have Baby, the leopard. We have a leopard. We have an animal that's the big issue, and I guess the subplot of how to deal with this leopard, and maybe that's supposed to be the other comparable difference with the whole switcheroo of the luggage. There's no animal in there. But there's also an element in Bogdanovich's film where somebody is, trying to abscond the funding away from him. There's two finalists. One of them, Howard Bannister, and the other one is Hugh. His name is Hugh Simon, but the way he says his name is Hugh Simon, or something. It's so bizarre that, of course, every time he says his name, people are thinking he's saying you. And he says, I am you. And the other person says, you're me? And it's like, I am you. And it's like, how could you be me? And it just, he has all those comedic type things that are really, like I said, old school, sort of one-liners, sort of vaudevillian one-liners, I guess you could say, that were transported into the 1972 era. So anyway, as all these hijinks are going on, it's just going to sort of fast forward. David Huxley and Katharine Hepburn, Susan Vance, they're running all over the rural area trying to find this leopard that they don't realize is actually supposed to be a pet for her aunt. And so half the time she's trying to hide the fact that she has the pet leopard from her aunt. And then the other half of the time she's trying to recapture the leopard because it is her aunt's, and she's supposed to be getting possibly $1 million from her aunt, but her aunt might also give $1 million to the museum. So all these hijinks are running around with Baby and the dog at, well, he's a, if you ever saw a Thin Man, I believe it's the same dog that played Aster. It's that type of a dog. He sort of barks a lot, yaps a lot. He's a terrier. He's real excited. And he's extremely well-trained actor. So you have this whole thing about the leopard. You didn't know if the leopard was going to eat the dog or blah, blah, blah. All that's going on. Meanwhile, there's all these people who think that there's something wrong with Susan. They think that there's something wrong with Dr. Huxley. Dr. Huxley has been portrayed as sort of a nutcase to Susan's aunt, unbeknownst to him. That was her aunt who was going to give the $1 million. And it all comes to head towards the end when everyone's trying to find these leopard, and there's a switcheroo that occurs when there's a leopard in town with the circus who mauled a man, and they were actually going to take that leopard to the gas chamber or something like that. But Susan and David let that leopard loose thinking it's Baby and thinking those are the people from the zoo to help capture Baby. And then everybody ends up at the police station. Everybody. And everything has to be solved at the police station. People don't believe there's a leopard because nobody believes there's a leopard running around out there in the rural area. And then the people who have the bad leopard, who mauled a man, they're there trying to find their leopard. And they think that David's a little crazy because of something Susan said. And then the aunt ends up at the police station. At some point, Susan, David, the gardener, and the aunt's guests all end up behind bars. And then Susan, of course, the big troublemaker of the whole film, ends up going out and getting the bad leopard, unbeknownst to her. The good leopard and the dog were already at the police station. She brings the bad leopard back. Even the good leopard and the dog run from it into the... They go behind bars. It was hilarious. And then, of course, Miss Swallow, the young lady, Alice Swallow, who was Dr. Huxtable's fiance and the attorney for Susan's aunt, the attorney that David Huxtable was trying to get the money, they arrive to set everything straight. And in the end, in that film, Miss Swallow tells Dr. Huxtable, "Well, it's good I found out about you before we were married. You're just a butterfly." And I thought about my friend who loved butterflies, and I thought, well, that's like the first time I've ever heard anyone kind of use the word butterfly as a sort of derogatory term. So in the end of that film, Dr. Huxtable, who still a little bit afraid of Susan, he encounters her when she returns to his museum with the bone, the last bone that had been lost because the dog had taken it and, of course, a dinosaur bone, took it and hid it somewhere, buried it somewhere. And so then he tells Susan in the end, you know, after she confesses that she did all these things because she just wanted to keep him near and she couldn't think of any other way to do it, which I believe is the movie's way of saying maybe she won't be completely psychotically weird and strange for the rest of their life together. Possibly. It's sort of giving you a little psychological hint. But then he says that she did him a favor because it was the best day of his life, all those hijinks. And he said, and another thing, "I think I love you." And she's like, "Really?" And he said, yes, I think I do. "I think I love you." Now, how could you get more certain than that? And then they go to embrace, and somehow she knocks down his entire dinosaur, and he's holding her by one arm, which I still think was a great shot, because he really was holding her by one arm after everything fell down, and he lifted her up by one arm, and she said, "Oh, David, your whole..." And it was like he had been working on his dinosaur for 4 years. It's like, "Your dinosaur..." And he goes, "Ah..." He's already frustrated, but before he gets a chance to even say, "I hate your guts, and I never want anything to do with you," she says, "Oh, and you forgive me, don't you? Oh, David." And he goes, "Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear." And he hugs her. What more can he do? Because he loves her. You know, love does that to us. We can't help ourselves. We're just stuck in it. There's nothing you can do but just go with the chaotic roller coaster ride. Switching back over to What's Up, Doc. In What's Up, Doc, the chaos in that place even involved fire, people busting through windows, people in torn pajamas, water damage. It was a big mess. You think that what more could happen? He goes to the obligatory sort of, he uses sort of the three-act play Bogdanovich does, which is typical for narratives in Hollywood, and then it seems like things calm down after the place is burnt up and Eunice is completely disgusted with Howard Bannister and blah, 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 blah. Howard Bannister may... He finds out that he actually is in... He actually been asked to the wealthy man's house to present, I guess, the check to him, or to have him demonstrate his rocks so they can make the final decision of the check. And the hotel manager who arrives, perfect person to play that. If you've ever seen Magnum P.I., the person who played the hotel manager who asked Howard Bannister to leave, it was the, I can't remember his name in Magnum P.I., but it was the, John Hillerman, that's his name. John Hillerman, and he played the straight-laced guy who was of English descent and more hoity-toity versus Magnum P.I., who was, you know, all kinds of craziness. So Peter Bogdanovich was really good at casting people that were giving that contrast, even in the smaller roles, to keep that in your head, that there's this chaos juxtaposed to the straight-laced. And there was even, in that scene where he's telling Howard Bannister to leave, he said, the people of the hotel, the workers of the hotel, have a message for you. And he said, yes. And he said, they want you to leave. And he said, well, when? He said, yesterday. And he said, that soon? He said, yes. And he said, well, do you think there's another room that I could... And he goes, no. I mean, he just... The room is still falling apart as they're talking. And he said, where did you think you would be going from here? He said, well, maybe I could just wait in the lobby. He said, no. He was very elegant in saying, get the hell out, you're a complete disaster, and I'm two steps from having you arrested. It was just perfect. And then everything moves to the rich guy's house, where we get the denouement kind of thing take place, because all the cases are there. Because one person's following one case, they thought they had one case, it was the wrong case, and then all these people are converging. Eunice has been sent to the wrong address thanks to Barbra Streisand's character. Like I said, it's not really cunning, but it's strategic, because she's still trying to hold on to Howard Bannister any way she can. And Eunice walks into it's such a bad neighborhood. She's standing there with that weird wig, and this blue, like baby blue dress that's so school marm, kind of, I don't know. And then she's got the little blue shoes. And the taxi driver, she said, you didn't want me to wait, did you, lady? And she said, yes. And he said, I didn't think you did. And he completely peels out of there like he doesn't want to be in the neighborhood. And she starts walking up to this really creepy, horrible-looking building that only, you know, we would think crackheads would be in there doing God knows what. And she walks up those crickety stairs and walks in where there's a bunch of men that are beating the living daylights out of some guy who's almost dead. and she sees the case, they got the wrong case, with Howard's rocks. And, of course, she's immediately like, what are you doing with Howard's rocks? It was a perfect comedic scene. And so they bring her to the right address, or she's brought them. These criminals are now there with all these other people trying to get these cases, because I don't even know what those criminals were for. I think the jewelries, I don't know. They were just, everyone's after all these different cases. And then we get erupted to a whole nother level of chaos where they're running through the streets of San Francisco and cars and on foot and on bikes and tearing things up, trying to get the cases, and all this damage lands them all in court. So now we are back to some kind of jail court situation. And there's this really crickety, frail judge who's seen so much of the ilk of society. He has the worst attitude in the world. He wants to lock them all up in chains and put them out on islands. And he says at one point to his bailiff, he said, what are those pills for? The bailiff asked, and he says, well, this yellow pill reminds me to take the red pill. And then he said, well, what's the blue pill for, judge? And he said, they're afraid to tell me what that pill's for. He's so frail. And you know, he's just so fed up. He thinks, he's telling the bailiff, just look at him, just the scourge of the earth. And he goes, well, judge, those are just the spectators. And he goes, oh. Then he says he wants it to be complete quiet. He doesn't want any chaos. Or he's going to just throw the book at everybody. And all of a sudden, three different doors open, and all these people from that chaotic hotel scene and everything, they all show up, and everyone's trying to talk, and one person, the judge is telling the bailiff to get straight jackets. Everything's like, nobody can really sort of get the story out. And when Howard Bannister agrees to tell the story, to straighten it all out, it's so bad that the judge a couple times says, let's just skip over this part. And he's taking steadily more drugs, the judge, and he can see this. He's got like a whole mouthful of blue pills in his mouth, chewing up, terrible. And then Howard Bannister says, do you want me to skip over this next part too? And he goes, oh, please, no, let's just get this done. And he said, who are you in the blanket? You seem to be at the center of everything. And here comes. She takes the blanket off, and Barbara Streisand says, hello, Daddy. Of course it would be his daughter. Oh, my God. It was a crazy, crazy film. It reminded me of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which was just full of the old comedians, including Jimmy Durante and all those guys, Phil Silvers, Don Knotts. I mean, it's just, if you like old-time comedy, stuff like Bob Newhart, things like that, you're going to want to watch What's Up, Doc, if you haven't seen it. So that's how the film basically ends. The woman who had the jewels that were stolen, she gave a reward to the people who found it. It all got split down. It was $20,000, but after paying off all of Howard's damages because of Barbra Streisand, he gets something like $5 or something. And then Eunice ends up with the rich guy, and Judy ends up with Ryan O'Neill, who confesses in the airplane that he was sorry he said all those mean things and that she should know that he loves her. And, of course, she's on the same plane to go with him back to his town so they can live happily ever after with their chaotically strange kids or something. Anyway. That was the romantic comedy. When you watch any romantic comedies in the future, if you can, try to watch a romantic comedy and a romantic drama at the same time. Well, not the same time. On the same day. Like maybe one right after the other. And then compare notes and see how similar they are, except one has a whole bunch of one-liners in it or something. But they all say sort of the same thing. You know, the dramatic romance. It's going to be, there's a reason we can't be together, whether it's sickness or, you know, different cultures, religions, different parts of the world, whatever. And it's telling you that it's still possible for that love, but it's going to be difficult. The romantic comedy, it's like, it's assured, no matter how crazy it is. So just take a good look at that. See how it makes you feel about, think about your own love life, whatever you have or had, or whenever you fell in love at any point in your life, and think about how your love life could easily fit into some of these. If you just upstep some of the crazy or the drama. Anyway, that was basically it. I hope that I covered enough of the film so that you can understand why romantic comedies work so much for us, our hopes and dreams and fears related to love relationships, and also to help you look a little closer at some of the movies that you see, you know, and how they can actually help you later in life or in your life now, however. Okay, let's go ahead and take a good look at the schedule coming up. Just about out of time. Let's see. Tomorrow we have Friday Traffic Jam at 5 p.m. with Lennis. It's an hour entree into your weekend. I'm not sure. She said she's going to be doing it, and it's going to be a surprise. We'll see how she works that out since tomorrow's 4th of July. Then on Saturday, we have Time to Love with Lydia Pello, and her show is Spiritual Homeostasis. And that's about trying to maintain the spiritual balance on a regular basis in your life. Well, basically, homeostasis means that's sort of ingrained in us to try to maintain that balance at all costs. So we'll see how Lydia attacks that and explains it to us from the self-love point of view. And then on Sunday, Lennis has psychic readings at 3 p.m. Pacific time. She had just a wildfire last Sunday. She had like 33 callers. She couldn't even get to all of them. 10 of them had to be turned away. So call early and call often, because she's still running her, she decided to continue her ninth caller gets a free psychic reading, which is worth $60. It's $60 value. So Sunday, and then on Monday we have LNB Passage to Empowerment at 7 p.m. bringing mental health into the light. Next week, starting on Monday, the Essence of Success Network is going to be talking about, in some form or fashion, mental health balancing issues. Because we just want to make sure that people understand that there's help out there, and much better to go that route than to pick up a gun and start shooting. It doesn't normally help anything. And let's see, then we go to Tuesday with BYO Brilliance. The Brilliance is Seeking Help. That's at 6 p.m. And one of the things that I'm going to try to focus on that show is the stigma and the reason it's so deadly in society today. Then on Wednesday, it's in the studio with Lennis. She's going to be discussing, one of her main topics are relationships and how mental health issues affect those relationships. And that's at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. That brings us back to Thursday with Filmcology. And the movie that I chose is Nuts. The reason I chose that movie for next week is because in the mental health field, there's a lot of processes that go on if you have some issues and you don't seek help early, or you don't have somebody on board to understand what's going on with you. And there's a lot of negative issues associated with the mental health field by people that probably should know better, but maybe they're burnt out, or I don't know, maybe they have something to prove. Just like any other field, there are problems. But we will talk about what you can do to try to help yourself and protect yourself from some of the things that happened to the people in that film, Nuts. So, that just about does it, everybody. Thank you for joining us on Filmcology. Apologize for the weird tongue thing. I can't remember why I bit my tongue something. I wasn't chewing any gum, but so I will sound much more normal, I believe, next Thursday. And have a happy 4th of July, everyone. Thank you for listening. If you're listening out in the archives, you've hit this from a podcast or tuned in from your computer anywhere, really do appreciate it, and appreciate anyone who has called in or is out in the chat room. You can get a chance to check the chat room today, but we'll try to get on that next week. Anyways, you all, happy 4th of July if you're in the United States. I know you already had Canada Day earlier this week. If you're in Canada and wherever you are in the world, have a great weekend. Goodbye, everybody.